Welcome into a new episode of the Locked On Nets podcast. Today we're talking the greatest Twitter war in Nets history, or at least the most recent one, specifically amongst beat writers. Then we're going to tell you how the Nets got blown out against the Philadelphia 76ers, and finally, why Joe Harris is a must-keep for the Brooklyn Nets this offseason. All that and more on this episode of Locked On Nets. Let's get it.
You are Locked On Nets, your daily Brooklyn Nets podcast. Part of the Locked On Podcast Network, your team every day.
And we're back, the start of another episode of the Locked On Nets podcast. You are listening to Locked On Nets, part of the Locked On Podcast Network. I am your host, your tour guide through Netsdom, Gavin Shaw, after 4 years covering the Phoenix Suns and doing an assortment of other stuff at the Walter Cronkite School of Journalism. I took a little break, moved back to New York to work for the NFL and cover your Brooklyn Nets, and I'm joined by the mystery man. He works like 12-hour days sometimes and then comes on and grinds for you on the Locked On Nets podcast. My hero, Joshua Bass. Josh, how's it going?
Yeah, you gotta prioritize. And the Nets always have a special place in my heart.
Yeah, no, I know.
Regardless of anything else that's going on.
They're your release. Some people do yoga, some people box, some people run. You get on your couch and you watch these terrible, terrible Nets games. Last night we got another example of that. The Philadelphia 76ers, a 121-95 win over the Brooklyn Nets, but the season is so far over and that game was so bad. I want to start off talking about something completely different. One of my favorite Twitter wars in recent memory, it was Brian Lewis of the Post against Stephen Bondi of the NYDN. So two heavy hitters in the New York basketball media scene. Josh, I would say they're on par with ourselves, Mike Breen, people in that category. Yeah. Anyway,
do you know if it's Stephen or Stephen? It's always hard with these Twitter guys.
Yeah, no, it's these Twitter guys. Yeah, these blog boys. Yeah. I'm gonna go with Stefan for the sake of argument, but I guess I'd love to have him on sometime. So maybe we'll find out. Maybe we'll get some more insight on this argument. All right. So Brian, I think it'd be good if we released a two-parter, like one like the Brian Lewis angle and one the Stephen Bondi angle. So I'm gonna be reaching out to both of them. All right. Anyways, Brian Lewis, the tweet that triggered it all, it was just about D'Angelo talking about Kenny Atkinson benching him, and he says that's a coach's decision. He went with what he rolled with. It worked. We won. It's cool. And then Bondi just takes it in a completely different direction, or slightly different direction, slightly relevant. And he says, I know that Sean Marks is a genius, parentheses, just read his press clippings, but if everyone knew that D'Angelo Russell had a knee problem pre-trade, isn't that a negative mark on the great genius? And then Brian Lewis makes the case that salt intensifies, and he has a gif along with that. Bondi says, is it salt or a realistic assessment of a 45-114 record? Mic drop. And then Lewis says it's not salt in the context of Marx's work or a discussion of the Nets rebuild, but it is salt when it's responding to a tweet quoting one player commenting about one coach's decision that doesn't involve aforementioned GM. And then they start arguing about whether or not Brian Lewis actually called D'Angelo Russell Steve Nash. So on the surface, pretty insignificant, but I don't know. I thought it's interesting to like see how people like outside of like the Nets media and like you and me view Sean Marks, because I know I think me more so than you, I'm like a little guilty sometimes of like overhyping Marks when obviously like they haven't done anything great yet. But again, like I always come at it from the perspective that like he was handed arguably the worst basketball situation in NBA history, and he's made a lot of good moves to remedy that and turn this team into a functionally bad franchise instead of the worst one of all time. Josh, what do you think about the Twitter war and then kind of the greater angle there?
Yeah, I mean, I don't know exactly why Bondi feels the need to always jump into Nets matters. He used to cover the team, obviously. Now he's moved to Manhattan, covers the Knicks.
Traitor.
And it seems like he just kind of misses, I don't know, maybe he misses being a big fish in a small pond with the Nets, because he's always outclassed by Isola and Berman of the Post.
Yeah.
Not even outclassed, just outshone rather.
Sure.
Because there is, like, everyone knows that that's the rivalry when it comes to Knicks beat writers. And there's also guys like Ali Anazone in the mix. So it's hard for him to find his niche within the Knicks community. So
yeah. And you didn't even mention Jan Begley, who I think is the
Jan
best.
Jan Begley, he's doing his thing. Yaya Dubin.
Yeah, I love Yaya Dubin.
Covered great Locked On Knicks host.
Yeah.
There's a lot of personalities at play.
Yeah, yeah.
Listen, he's going to go across to Brooklyn. He says, okay, Brian Lewis is here. The reason for me to come in and be that Skip Bayless hot take artist. So he's using that opportunity.
Yeah, no, I know. I thought, yeah, it seemed like, it just seemed weird that he jumped in. And I thought Brian.
He does, I think.
Does he? Yeah, I guess I've just missed it. I need to get more involved on Nets Twitter, but I don't know. I thought Lewis was like smart in like the way he defended it. He's like it is fair to go after like Marks as like a whole, but just to like bring it up out of nowhere, it was weird. And I'd be interested to like ask Bondi like what the issue there is, and like I'm sure he probably like wouldn't like say there is an issue, and this is just like a real like opinion, and like in his mind, like Nets beat writers are like inflating like what the team has. And Josh, I think you and I, like, I guess to look at Bondi's perspective on this, like occasionally have the same opinion of like people on Twitter being way too high on the Nets. And we saw the shirt with like D'Angelo 2, Jahlil Okafor 3. And like it's a Sean Marks draft or something, like when Okafor, and we're going to talk about this later, probably won't be on the team next year. And D'Angelo might not be that good. So I think we have some of the same issues that Bondi does, but it seems like going after Brian Lewis, who to me seems like very even and well-reasoned, is like the wrong guy to target this at.
Yeah, don't make Brian Lewis the scapegoat. He's a nice guy. But I think that I kind of agree with what Bondi's saying, just his approach is very heavy-handed.
Okay, that's fair. Yeah, I guess we don't have to spend any more time on this. I just wanted to say that I love that this ended with Bondi acknowledged that Lewis did not in fact say D'Angelo Russell will be Steve Nash, and saying that he has instead that he has the potential to be Steve Nash. He comments sarcastically, coincidentally, I might have the potential to be Thor. And Brian Lewis responds with a gif of Thor saying Thor is disappointed in his comment, you're not worthy of being Thor. I thought that was like an incredible way for it to end, because it was just like so cartoony, and it makes me think like that they're actually friends, except Bondi like didn't respond to that after that. So I'm not actually sure. Okay.
I think that, you know, just going back to that.
Sure. Could Bondi be Thor? I think that's the question you have to answer now.
And worst case scenario, the best part of this is that I did get the Salt Intensified meme into my life, because I've never seen that before, but definitely going to be using that moving forward.
Yeah, no, I agree. I think it'd be good in some of our group chats, because I know I get really salty sometimes. A friend of the pod, James Gow, gets really salty sometimes. So I think I think you're kind of the classic troll of the group,
I'm
the Josh.
Person.
Yeah, so I think you'd be a good person to like incorporate that into our conversations. I think that's a very natural next step in your evolution as a human being, and as a man of God. All right, Nets Sixers, Philadelphia wins 121. To 95. Not a super exciting game, as you pointed out to me, Josh, because I tried to record it and then was very upset when I only had the second half. The first half of the game was not on TV because of the Yankees game, and this is a phenomenon I'm unfamiliar with, because I obviously, like, I would never watch Nets games as scheduled viewing before this year, and now the Yankees are back, and all of a sudden the Nets are getting bumped, which is a little frustrating to me. Do you think there should be a yes two for Nets games?
I think there is a yes. The Nets used to play on some other channel when the Yankees would come on. And it was more relevant when they were good, because obviously people want to watch their games, but now no one really cares. And like you, they don't really understand that it's on Fox Sports Go for the first half. But there's some sort of weird Yes Amalgamation channel that they are shipped to every April.
Yes Amalgamation, that's the name of it. I wonder, I'm confused. Is the implication there that the Yankees are more important than the Nets?
Yeah, I'm not really sure where they're getting that hypothesis from. I wonder if it was like a double-A Yankees training game where they bumped the Nets.
Yeah, I'd love if they did like some shared like This Is SportsCenter style commercials, which I know they're doing with like the whole like Yankees like nine-man booth thing. If they had like one with like Damari Carroll and Giancarlo Stanton, or Gary Sanchez and Quincy Acey, like I don't know, I think that, or maybe Nick Stauskas and Tyler Austin, I just think there would be some cool combinations there. It'd be interesting to see them cross promote.
Yeah, no, I like that idea, and also that horrible Yankees nine man rotation booth commercial is,
yeah,
so cringeworthy. Like I get it's supposed to be ironic, but I still can't watch it.
Yeah, I don't think it's. I think the players at the beginning are kind of funny. I don't think like the actual booth stuff is that funny. What was I gonna say? I also think it'd be. I know this is like late in the season to do this, but I think it'd be cool if they did like an ESPN style like announcers switch, like Michael Kay got to do a Nets game, and I mean, I guess Ryan Rucco is like the human embodiment to that. But like, I imagine like Ian Eagle doing a Yankees game, and just like I'd love to hear an Ian Eagle home run call. Like, I feel like he could really nail it, even though he's not a big baseball head as far as I know.
And also Michael Kay, he's a very polarizing announcer, but I feel like he does have so many like incredible sayings that me and my friends always make fun of, and also his weird quirks where he's afraid of ketchup and. What if there's other food quirks? He's like never eaten a banana.
Is that true?
Yeah. Sure.
Does he talk? Does that come up a lot?
He's never had like salmon. I don't.
Oh, okay. I got to.
He's afraid of condiments and never.
Mike, you want some ketchup? Ah! I don't know. I feel like that's a good bit. I'd like that over the 9-man booth. That's interesting. I think it's funny that like you're supporting me in this trend. I want to do anything but talk about this game because it was just so bad.
Well, I don't think there's anything we really need to discuss because there were just no highlights, like no positives on that side. They just came out flat. I had some decent momentum in the first quarter, but. I mean, the second and third quarter was just abysmal. They're just trying to actually run out the season at this point because that effort should not happen.
Yeah, well, one thing I've noticed recently, and like again, it was like a really big issue in this game, is that like the Nets have like a lot of trouble matching up in transition or even semi-transition. Like sometimes when a team just pushes off a made basket, they don't know where their guy is, and a lot of times D'Angelo Russell is the primary culprit. Because I remember like the reason he got pulled from the Heat game. Is because after a minute, or this was definitely part of it. It wasn't the only reason. He also had like four turnovers in a row. But there was that one play where Dragic just took an inbound and Russell just like was like anticipating a pick and never grabbed him and then just let Dragic drive in for a layup. And then literally I don't know if like Russell was supposed to be guarding Ben Simmons, but he was the guy closest to him. And there was a play where like Simmons just took an inbounds and was like, oh, you're not going to guard me? I'm going to go get a dunk. And like that's exactly what he did. And it's not just Russell. Like I saw like a play where Dante Cunningham made that mistake, and like it's just pretty consistent across the board where these guys like just aren't sharp in defensive transition, and like it's those little margins in my mind that often win or lose basketball games. So that was something I noticed that I thought was pretty interesting. Also, I think the biggest blessing of this game not being on TV, this is via Ian Eagle on the broadcast. Apparently the Nets did not make a 2-point field goal for the first 17 minutes of this game. Could you imagine that happening any time before 2015? Like even for like a bad team, that's like astounding.
Well, the Nets always find new ways to surprise you, so I'm not too shocked about that.
They had made 5 twos with 8:30 left in the third quarter. That's almost 30 minutes into the game. They had made 5 twos.
Not what you want. But also going back to Simmons, I feel it's so interesting because obviously everyone goes under the screens against him because he can't shoot, but I think it honestly plays his advantage because he gets like a running start every time he's going to the basket because he has a huge runway to work with since no one's trailing him on the screen. And since he's 6'10 with his wingspan is 7'1", 7'2", he's so long that once he gets that head of steam going, he's easily able to finish at the rim.
Yeah, well, that's what I really love about his game because he really has like turned something that should be the ultimate weakness in a modern NBA player and has completely covered it up. And it's certainly that natural talent and size combination that's obviously the biggest factor in his success around the basket. But his variety of finishes always really impressed me. And they're really old school. They're the type of shots you don't see a lot of modern NBA players have. And the guys who do have it are usually smaller, like Mike Conley-style point guards who need to finish in the lane over bigs. But because of exactly what you mentioned, like guys not wanting to get beat by Simmons off the dribble, they're playing back. So they're still there to meet him at the rim. But he's all this like array of runners and floaters and baby hooks that just gets it done. And just, I mean, I love the fact that like, because I didn't really see him doing a ton of that in college. And I watched him quite a bit when he was at LSU. Like, I love the fact that he like used that year off to really thoroughly develop that part of his game. And I guess you could use that as an argument against him being eligible for Rookie of the Year, but that's neither here nor there. I'm just really impressed with his package around the basket.
Yeah. I mean, you're impressed by his package.
Yeah, no, that will be the pull quote, and I'm okay with that. Nick Stauskas, very good game, 13 points in 14 minutes, or at least he did have that. I think he ended up playing more. He ended up playing 21 minutes and finishing with 13 points. But at one point, he had 13 points in 14 minutes, and he scored like 11 in like a 2.5-minute stretch That is pretty awesome. It's cool to watch him work, cool to watch him get some minutes over these last two games and play well. I mean, I think as long as Joe Harris and Alan Crabb are on the roster, I don't think there's a role for him in the rotation, but he's still like a nice breaking case of emergency three-point shooter. And then Jahlil Okafor, who started off really slowly, scored like 15 points. I think possibly all of them came in the fourth quarter. I'm pretty sure that's true. Maybe he had one bucket before the fourth, but I like the Sixers combination, having good games, even if they're not necessarily relevant to the Nets' long-term plans.
Yeah, I mean, I can't get excited about anything when we lost like 26 points. So, and probably with two guys that aren't going to be on the team next year, Stauskas, I would highly doubt he is. Okafor, I would assume not. I mean, I don't really know where else he's going to go, but it seems like he's clearly fallen out of favor with the Nets.
No, that's 100% true. Okay, because I waited way too long, we are going to be taking our first break of the episode. When we come back, we are going to maybe have a few concluding points on next Sixers, and then we're going to get into a quick preview of Nets free agency, all that and more up next on the Locked On Nets podcast. Attention cancer victims, if you or a loved one lived, worked, or visited Lower Manhattan in the months after the 9/11 attacks and have been diagnosed with cancer, federal benefits and health care may be available. Attorney Eddie Markowitz has helped many families recover substantial benefits from the September 11th Victims Compensation Fund. The James Zadroga Health and Compensation Act has been extended, but time is limited. Attorney Markowitz is proud to serve as counsel to the Zadroga family. Let him help you too. These benefits are not just for rescue workers, but to anyone who qualifies. The fund covers many cancers, including prostate, skin, lung, and breast. Please call 1-800-LAW-HELP. That's 1-800-LAW-HELP to see if you qualify. And welcome back in to the Locked On Nets podcast. Gavin Shaw, Josh Bass, the Philadelphia 76ers. After tonight, actually, they beat the Detroit Pistons, winning their 12th game in a row. Obviously, depressing to see the Nets not play particularly well, but pretty cool from a Sixers perspective. I've low-key been a fan for the last two, three seasons. I love seeing the process pay off. I love J.J. Redick. I love that Markelle Fultz is finally playing well. I've been a big T.J. McConnell head since day one, except for when he was in college when I hated him. 10 points, 2 assists. Rashawn Holmes shot better than 50%. Marco Bellinelli, a great addition. I love their team. I love that Ben Simmons is leading them on this run without Joel Embiid. I think it's incredible, and I think it's indicative of just how special a player he's going to be. All right, so that's it. The Sixers, a massive win over the Brooklyn Nets. And now Josh and I are going to be talking Nets free agents, and just quickly, like, obviously this is going to be a continuing conversation throughout our offseason pods, and I'm sure we'll probably end up doing individual episodes on each of these guys and really breaking down if the Nets should offer them a contract, what the Nets should offer them, and generally what we think they're going to do. But the list is as follows. Joe Harris, Jahlil Okafor, Dante Cunningham, Quincy Acey, and Nick Stauskas. To me, Josh, let me know if you disagree on this, but far and away the most important of that group is Joe Harris, and it's kind of a relevant time to be bringing it up because our boy Mike Scotto, he of the marriage contract, recently reported that after talking to 8 NBA executives, the estimate around that amongst that group is that Harris could command anywhere from $4 to $7 million a year, and to me that seemed maybe slightly conservative. Like I would definitely like pin it like more around the $7 million range, given the fact that he's turned into one of the more, obviously low volume, but one of the more efficient scorers in basketball.
I don't know. I think that's fair because he's someone that could get overexposed if he's averaging more than 24 minutes a game and that he is on the Nets. Like, I just don't see what his ceiling is. I'd be perfectly fine paying him $5, $6, even $7 million a year, but I don't think he'd ever get anything above that just because He's somewhat limited of a player, even though he's really improved. And also his reputation around the league is still a path of someone who's like a fringe NBA player, even though he's proven that he's a solid guy.
I know that's true amongst media guys, but I wonder, and maybe it's true.
I think media guys are smarter than a lot of GMs.
Yeah. I think that used to be true.
He's like Joe Harris, like he's really good now. He's not going to know.
Well, no, but I mean, he's going to get fired. I don't know. I think in general, I think I don't know if you're giving GMs enough credit. Like, I think there are like a lot of guys. Like, I could see like even like a team like Phoenix, who's like always like who's like has like tons of money to throw around. I think they do. Maybe they don't because they're paying Tyson Chandler and Jared Dudley like $20 million a piece. But But like theoretically, like a team like that, like if they look at like a Joe Harris and they're like, oh, I want him to grow with this core, or you look at like the exact opposite end of NBA teams, and you look at teams that feel like they're like a piece or two away from contending for a title. Like I know I mentioned to you a bunch of times on this podcast, like I think Joe Harris would have been incredible on the Thunder this year, or even like obviously like I don't think the Warriors could have any room, but like on a team like the Warriors, like. And like they don't really need a wing, but like you're looking for just like a guy to like throw into the mix there. Like he'd be really interesting as another shooter and defender. I don't know. I think, I mean, this has been a semi nonviolent conflict between us all season. But to me, like Joe Harris is a guy who fits in a lot of different systems. And like obviously, like if your team's bad, like he's not going to make the difference between your team being bad or good. But as a finishing piece on a really, really good team, or as a young guy to like kind of set the tone on like a developing team, I think he's a really interesting asset. And I really do feel like he's going to stay in Brooklyn. And it seems like he's really loyal to Kenny Atkinson. And like he appreciates the fact that not every coach would trust him the way Atkinson does and highlight his skill set the way Atkinson does and let him attack the basket the way Atkinson does. But I'm not sure. Like, I feel like there could be a team that just likes him like a little bit more than everyone else. And maybe that's the Nets, but maybe there's one more team in there.
No, I think you made a good point in that he's not going to make a difference on a bad team. He's the garnish or the drizzle to the meal. Like, unchopped,
yeah.
When you're finishing the meal and there's 10 seconds left, and what's the host named? Something Alden.
No, Alden Brown's Iron Chef. It's a Ted.
Ted, whatever his name is. You'll research while I'm talking. No, Ted Allen. So it's like when Ted Allen screams, 10 seconds left, chefs. And they're all scrambling because it's fake drama, as if they're going to not present their meal on time. And they're doing the garnish. And they're making it look presentable. That's what Joe Harris is. He's not going to be the main course or the dessert or even the appetizer. He's something that makes it look nice.
Yeah, Josh, it's like how I finish all my soups with a little bit of dill or parsley. And that's I'm going to refer to that as Joe Harrising in the future. Anyways, yeah, I don't know. I love him. I think he's great. I think he's going to get closer to $7 million a year. And I'd generally be surprised if he doesn't end up on the Nets, but I think it would be a pretty significant loss for the Nets if he doesn't come back for whatever reason. All right, next guy up. Let's talk about Jahlil Okafor. Really good game, and I thought it was pretty interesting. Brian Lewis of The Post, the aforementioned Brian Lewis of The Post, wrote an interesting article about Okafor where there was like a quote from Kenny Atkinson in there just saying like maybe it would be like, you know, like in regards to Okafor not really playing much after the All-Star break. I think it's now four games he's played in since the All-Star break. And there was a quote from Kenny Atkinson in there saying maybe it'd be different if Jahlil had a full offseason with the team and we could have figured out the best way to incorporate him. And then Okafor responded to that saying, I don't really know what that means. I've been here for 3 or 4 months. Saying a full offseason would help me. I've been with these guys for 3 or 4 months now, done everything they've asked of me. I'm not sure what they want, but everyone's treated me really well. So I think that's like reasonable from like Jahlil Okafor. And like at the same time, the answer is like he's a terrible defender and you can't keep him on the floor without bleeding points. And that's really all it comes down to.
Yeah, I mean, he just doesn't fit the style at the end of the day. And I don't know if Kenny Atkinson is going to be willing to compromise that style for someone that's not necessarily like a dynamic game changer. So unless he proves that he can be that and someone that's a really transformative player in that low post mold, I don't really see him having a fit on this team. And I feel bad for him because from what it seems like, he's worked really hard since he's gotten on the Nets. And he was in a bad scenario in Philly. But at the same time, like, feeling bad for someone doesn't mean they just probably lost.
No, that's 100% true. And again, like, obviously, like, I'm not, like, I agree with you sympathizing, but, like, still gets paid millions of dollars to watch basketball games courtside. So, not a terrible life. But, I don't know, I guess to my previous point, like, I mean, I think, like, there is real offensive talent there, and we've discussed this a few times back when he was more relevant, but you really did see it in the fourth quarter of that Sixers game, and obviously, like, it's a blowout, like, you can only take away so much, but, like, you just see the diversity of skill set, like, in him, like, attacking guys on the face-up and dunking and after beating someone off the dribble, having, like, a little bit of a low post game and having, like, a couple different jump hooks. He hit, like, a fadeaway from the foul line at the end of a shot clock. He hit a three-pointer from the corner after hesitating and then facing up and firing. Like, he has the makings of like a really, really nice offensive player. But as you said, it's about a system, and like it feels like whenever he comes into the game, the Nets kind of just stop doing what they do, and feed him the ball, or the Nets run their offense, and then as like a last second option, they're like, oh, we could throw it to Ja, and if they use him like the way Nets bigs are used in Atkinson's system, then it doesn't really maximize his skill set, because I think ideally what you want is exactly what Jared Allen is, a rim roller, a putback guy, and not necessarily someone who's going to play isolation basketball in the post. And I think, to me, it's not a question of his offensive talent, but it's the fit in the system combined with the fact that he's terrible defensively makes it extremely unlikely he's going to be back on Brooklyn next year. The thing I'm curious about with him is what system does that guy fit into, because teams don't really structure their offenses around a low post threat anymore. So I'm fascinated to see where he could end up.
Hey, let's not pretend like he gives this kind of effort every night. I mean, this kind of offensive outburst is pretty rare for him still, regardless of whether he's being used properly or not.
Sure, so but I don't...
It's not like it's just the defense and just like him being incorporated into the system. He has some talent. I don't really think he has that much, just because he has a high draft pedigree and can do some fancy footwork doesn't mean he's a talented player.
I don't know. I disagree with you. I think he's a really good scorer, and like I think you gotta like
based on what? Because he's never had a good true shooting percentage. Like just because he has footwork doesn't mean you're putting the ball in the basket at the end of the day.
I don't know. I mean, like, and maybe like, you know what? I guess what I'm trying to say is like I think like 10 years ago he was like a really talented offensive player. Because you're right. Like it is like kind of like I always mess up this word. Anachronistic. Okay, thanks, Josh. And it's kind of he's kind of anachronistic, like just in the sense that like you bring up the true shooting percentage, and that's a fair point. But it's like it's very different now because like obviously like there's more of a premium placed on efficiency.
Have more space to work with now than he would 10 years ago.
Well, no, that's not the case I'm making. I get the argument I'm making is that it's hard for a post up big to be really efficient, because even though he's really really good at posting up, that's inherently such an inefficient play that he could be dramatically better than 80% of the league at that skill, but still on a holistic level be an inefficient offensive player, because most guards are shooting threes, which drives up their efficiency. And most bigs that aren't superstars in this league are effective because they're really good at rolling to the rim and getting dunk after dunk after dunk. So it's interesting because he is really good at this one skill, but it's a skill that's almost irrelevant in the modern NBA. So I think the truth is somewhere in the middle between our 2 points. And he is a real talent, but just in a way that's not very relevant to the modern NBA.
Yeah, I don't know. I still completely disagree. I think if you're really a top-level player at that skill, like a LaMarcus Aldridge who's been doing this year, you should be taking advantage of the smaller NBA and having more space to work around for you. Because the Nets do give him a lot of space to work. He's just not that good at the end of the day, in my opinion. And it's unfortunate because he was amazing at Duke, number 3 overall pick. But he just hasn't been able to translate that success at the pro level. So
yeah, I'm interested.
He does that on the net for another team in the future.
I'm really fascinated. Like you could tell me like in 10 years that he had a great career, and like not a great career, but like he found a team and he found a role on some really good team, and he just came off the bench and averaged like 20 and 10 per 36 minutes and was really efficient. Or you could tell me he like leaves for China after this year and never plays in the NBA again. And I'd believe both. So I'm fascinated to see what happens with him going forward. Okay, we're gonna take one more break here. I know this pod is running a little bit long, and then talk about or quickly run through our final three. And welcome back into the Locked On Nets podcast. We're going to go rapid fire on our final free agents. And I know it seems kind of random that, well, Joe Harris isn't random, but kind of random that we focused on Jahlil Okafor and like we're not spending a ton of time on Dante Cunningham, Quincy Acey, and Nick Stauskas. But I promise this offseason we will look into all three of them. All right, Dante Cunningham has been a really solid contributor since coming over from the Pelicans. Per 36 minutes, 13 points, 8 rebounds. The bigger numbers for me are just how efficient he's been as a scorer, 47% from the field and 41% from 3-point range, even though every time he shoots, I think it's going to miss from there. But he's been awesome, and he's an interesting fit as kind of an upgrade to that Quincy Acey role. I'm interested to see, Josh, if you think he potentially has a place on this team going forward.
I mean, I think it'll be great to have him on the roster next year. The only thing I'm worried about is him being another Quincy Acey, in the sense that last year, Acey shot 48% on threes with the Nets, then comes back this year and has been terrible. And all the Nets fans on Twitter, and myself included, have been ragging on the guy and also ragging on Atkinson for playing him so much. So I could see Cunningham coming back next year and kind of being the whipping boy. But based on what he's done in a Nets uniform, definitely think it would be great to have him on the team as like a fourth big man type role.
Yeah, no, I'm definitely, I think that's a very valid point. And like, I don't think, I mean, for one, Cunningham hasn't been a 41% 3-point shooter for his career. I think he's around 37% for his career, but he does have a little bit more of a diverse offensive game than Quincy Acey. Okay, I way overhyped Cunningham. He's a 33% 3-point shooter for his career. So that should give you a good idea that regression is extremely likely going forward, at least as a 3-point shooter. He does have a little bit more of a diverse offensive game than Quincy Acey does to compensate for that. But all in all, Josh, I tend to agree with you. Like, if you could get him for the veterans minimum and bring him back on the end of the bench, I don't really mind him as a placeholder. But again, given how much Kenny Atkinson values that position in the Nets offense and having a floor spacer either next to Jared Allen or playing the five, depending on what lineup is out there on the floor, I think the Nets' biggest goal, in my opinion, should be to find some way to upgrade that spot. And again, those guys don't grow on trees. It's really hard to find someone who can hit threes credibly and defend and do a little bit more off the dribble. Like, usually those guys aren't just available. But I'm interested to see what Atkinson and Shaun Marks in this Nets offense could do at that spot. And if you can't find an upgrade there, I don't think Cunningham's the worst option in the world.
Not completely with you on that, Gavin. Wouldn't mind seeing him back next year. Moving on to AC, I feel like just better to end the marriage here, or get divorced, rather. Kids call it these days. Because, yeah, I mean, it's not a good situation. AC's played so much this year. It's definitely been overexposed, not his fault. He's kind of been thrust into a situation where he needs to perform because the rest of the team doesn't have a lot of talented players, especially stretch big men. But I feel like he's been a whipping boy for Nets fans all season. Would be better off letting him go somewhere else, seeing if he can latch onto another team.
Yeah, I don't disagree with you, but I'm of the opinion that the Nets are going to bring him back because I think Kenny Atkinson loves him. He loves having the option of just pulling him out. And like I think if you're anywhere like close to sniffing the playoffs, he's not a rotation player in the NBA, and you can make a very compelling argument that realistically the Nets won't be in that situation next year. Because of that, they could bring AC back for another go around. Like, I don't have a strong opinion one way or another, because I mean the only question for me like is that, like, can you upgrade that spot? And if you can, then maybe he doesn't come back, or maybe he comes back as a deep bench guy who doesn't actually play. So I'm interested to see how that goes. I don't really feel super strongly about it, but Josh, I think much to your chagrin, if I had to bet on it, I think he'd be on the roster next season. All right, you want to talk Sauce Castillo for a few minutes or a few seconds?
Yeah, well, yeah, I would not do that.
20, 30.
I like Sauskas, but that roster spot can definitely be upgraded. I don't know if that's going to happen this year. I wouldn't mind bringing him back as just a shooter off the bench. I think it's going to depend on if the Nets can re-sign Harris, and if they can. Obviously, Crabbe's not going anywhere because no one wants to take his contract. So I would get rid of Stauskas then, see if we can go for someone that's a little bit higher upside.
Yeah.
But if not, wouldn't mind having him back on the team. Just completely indifferent as his existence.
Yeah, no, I guess you're kind of with him like I am with AC. But I'll stand by what I said earlier in the podcast. Like, I think he's your break in case of emergency shooter. And I'm interested to see, like, kind of similar with Okafor. I mean, I'm interested to see what kind of NBA career he has, because it's very similar, where I could see him finding the right team and being a really, really good role player as a shooter in the mold of a Steve Novak or a poor man's Steve Kerr, if we want to go back to the past. Or I could see him going to Europe or China and thriving there for the next like 10 years. Like, I think, like, again, like a lot of teams have the mentality you can never have enough shooters. And I think he's developed a credible enough off the dribble game. And the big thing with him for the first 3 years of his career was he wasn't shooting well enough to be designated a shooter, or at least he was kind of running off reputation rather than production. And he's picked it up a little bit in terms of efficiency since coming over to the Nets. So I'm wondering where that pendulum swings with him, and I'm fascinated to see where it goes. All right, Josh, we went super long. I'm really happy with this episode, so I'm content to wrap it up here. The Nets play again this week, and their next opponent is the Milwaukee Bucks tomorrow night. So we will I'll hopefully record right after that one. I don't have anything going on tonight, that night, or any night. I'm antisocial. Anyways, so should be able to get that done for you tomorrow, and you can look out for that Friday morning in your podcast feed. For Josh, I'm Gavin. Peace out.